Hey, we are on record. And our matter number F-06-2490 consolidated with F-06-2709 Parker, Bay Parker et al. Versus State of California. Mr. Clint Montfort, you are arguing on behalf of the respondents, is that correct? Okay, sir, you have asked for 30 minutes, is that correct? And you are Mr. Moody? You have asked for 20 minutes, is that correct, sir? As you will note, there's a clock on the bench that counts down, so I'll let you keep track of your own time so you can reserve what you feel is appropriate for the purposes of rebuttal. Keep in mind that the panel is familiar with these issues. It's a very interesting case. So with that, you may begin, Mr. Moody.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ross Moody, Deputy Attorney General. I'm representing the appellants, State of California, Attorney General Harris, and the California Department of Justice. This case involves a facial constitutional challenge to California's 2010 statute regulating the commercial sale of handgun ammunition. And the key factor in this case is that this is a facial challenge. And there's been some discussion in the briefing about what standard should be applied in a facial challenge. And we believe that the correct standard is the strict standard, that the statute must be invalid in all applications. It is clear that there are at least two standards that are used in these cases. However, as the precedent from this court in Sanchez v. City of Modesto specifies, the more lenient standard that requires a showing merely of invalidity in the generality of cases is reserved for cases involving the First Amendment or abortion rights.
When you say abortion rights, what's that come under?
Like where would you classify that in the constitutional penumbra? It's a good question. I would say that it's...
Well, you glossed over that in briefing and today, that's just kind of an add-on to First Amendment rights. What amendment would that come from, or what clause?
I'm not prepared to discuss abortion generally here today, Your Honor. I don't see that it has any application to this case, merely to indicate
that... It's not First Amendment.
No. So far, we have two categories. We have First Amendment and we have abortion.
We have one category other than First Amendment.
That's true.
Whether it's actually a separate category or not, we don't know.
That's true. Maybe it is a First Amendment within First Amendment. But it's been described separately, and it's been described in the jurisprudence of this court. But be that as it may, the question is, should it apply here? And the offer being made by my opponents is that in a Second Amendment context, you should use this more lenient standard. And I have two main responses to that. The first one is this isn't a Second Amendment case. The best that they can do in that regard is to indicate that this case abuts the Second Amendment. This case is a vagueness case, and that's the way it was litigated below. The second point is that even if it were a Second Amendment case, all of the cases that we have found across the country since Heller and McDonald challenging Second Amendment on Second Amendment grounds, restrictions on firearms, apply the stricter test. They do not apply the more lenient test. And we collect those cases in our reply brief at pages 5 and 6 and in the answer to the amicus at page 2. So applying the facial review standard that is applicable here, which is that you must show that there is no that the statute fails in all cases, the statute does pass muster. And I would submit that anyone who's ever visited a gun store could give you a list of cartridges that are primarily for use in a handgun. We understand that there are some weapons, some long guns that fire a handgun cartridge, and there are some handguns that fire a rifle cartridge. But it is undisputed that there are a core group of cartridges that are primarily for use in a handgun. And this was developed in the record below. The one that we point out in our brief is the 25 automatic, which there's evidence in the record from from the respondents that indicates that they're not aware of any rifles that chamber that. So that's one example. If we only need one, there's your one. But I would submit to you that if you, again, if you go and look at handguns that are being used in the state of California, you're going to find the usual suspects of calibers. You're going to find 38 caliber, 357, 25, 10 millimeter, 11 millimeter, 45 caliber. Did I say 357 already? It's a group of calibers that are well understood. Now, if there is an oddball cartridge that people aren't sure about, that can be addressed in an as-applied challenge. That is not enough to facially invalidate the law.
What about, and we've sent you a letter about this, what if we implied a scienter requirement? What impact would that have on that argument?
We believe that there is a scienter requirement, and we have briefed that. We do not believe that this is a strict liability statute, Your Honor. I hesitate to try to explore exactly what it is, because I think that that should be left for a criminal prosecution where you have two contestants who really have skin in the game who can decide it. But I will note that the case that we cite of Jorge M., which is the California Supreme Court case on the Assault Weapons Control Act, they looked at a statute that was similar to this in the sense that it did not have an express mens rea requirement, but they did imply one. And the one that they implied using a seven-factor test was know or should have known that the characteristics on the weapon made it fall within the statute. And I think that something like that is probably appropriate here too, subject to some kind of refinement should a prosecution ever occur under this case. The second question by the court was whether or not the case should be limited to cartridges that are generally recognized as principally for use in handguns. I believe that that would be inappropriate to do in a facial challenge. I think that the way that the question is framed helps me answer it, which says, should it apply only to cartridges that are generally recognized? I think that that is a classic as-applied question, where if there's one type of cartridge that there's a debate about, then there can be a test case about it, there can be a discussion about it, there can be a back and forth with the Department of Justice about it, and we can get to the bottom of that. But I don't think that you need to, in deciding this case, which is just a straight facial challenge, reach that conclusion. So if there are no further questions from the bench, I would submit that this notion that a reasonable person cannot tell what is meant by principally for use in a handgun is simply false. If you do any kind of sporting shopping, if you are a gun owner, if you look at a cheaper than dirt catalog or any other catalog, you've got pages and pages listed as handgun ammunition and pages that are rifle ammunition. There may be some overlap, there may be some gray area, but in the main, people understand what they're talking about when they are talking about principally for use in a handgun. And in the case, the U.S. Supreme Court case of Hoffman Estates, the paraphernalia case, they point out that when a statute targets an enterprise that is an economic enterprise, people who are selling ammunition, that there is a lower standard for a vagueness challenge, because those people have an opportunity in the course of their business to figure out what are they selling? What are the ramifications of putting this information or this product out for sale, and what kind of restrictions are placed on it? And I think that the Hoffman case really provides a template for this court for how to decide this case. And unless there are further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Don't appear to be any at this time, sir. You have approximately 11 minutes remaining.
Thank you.
Mr. Monfort?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd like to briefly address today three points. First, I'd like to respond to the court's inquiries regarding whether a scienter requirement should be inferred in this case, or alternatively, or possibly along with whether or not the statute should be limited to ammunition that is generally recognized as principally for use in a handgun. I'd then like to briefly expand upon the difficulty in determining whether any ammunition is principally for use in a handgun. And if time permits, I'd like to briefly clarify the interplay with the Second Amendment in this suit. First, quickly, I'd like to quickly note that respondents are of the position, as the trial court correctly noted, that the law is vague under any standard, regardless of whether it's all applications or the generality of the cases standard. And turning first to the court's inquiry regarding a scienter requirement, respondents also acknowledge that a scienter requirement is often inferred or read into criminal statutes, and we're supportive of doing that to obviously prevent against strict liability convictions when criminal penalties are at stake. But while vagueness may mitigate a law's while mens rea may mitigate a law's vagueness in some circumstances, it simply doesn't in this case. The standard we're dealing with here, the principally for use in a handgun standard, this is something that people cannot know and cannot be expected to know, not only whether ammunition is actually meets that standard, but even what information should inform that standard. There's nothing in the statute beyond the words principally for use in a handgun as to how handgun ammunition should be defined.
Are you saying that there is no ammunition anywhere that the vast majority of users would agree is principally for use in a handgun?
That the vast majority of users would agree? I would say that is correct, Your Honor. Users of ammunition.
But even your own expert, in your expert's testimony, indicated there was some ammunition that was principally for use in handguns.
Right. When asked to estimate whether in his experience as an expert, whether or not he believed there were some that were used more often in a handgun, he gave his estimation as an expert. But again, this is the testimony of an expert witness, the former head of the Department of Justice's own Bureau of Firearms.
But it was your witness.
He was my witness, exactly. And to provide background on ammunition and the actual difficulty and expand upon the uses of every cartridge. Every cartridge fired in a handgun can be fired out of a rifle. And the point is that this is not information that is reasonably known by the average shooter, the occasional shooter, the person that goes to the shooting range sometimes, and even ammunition retailers alike. And to this extent, there's nothing beyond the statute to look to. Unlike other cases where, like the paraphernalia case that looks to whether the primary intended use, there's no examples to turn to. There are no factors to inform us as to what should guide the analysis, nor is there anything in the legislative history here. There's no regulations.
If we are to uphold your position in this and we apply a strict standard, do we necessarily have to find that there are no instances in which there is ammunition that's principally used in a handgun that a seller should know or reasonably knows or reasonably should know? Do we have to make a finding like that in order to get where you want us to go under a strict standard?
No, but I believe that is the case, though, because it's not as...
Why don't we have to make that finding? Because you're telling me that a strict standard means in all instances. Doesn't that... Maybe I didn't articulate it well enough, but doesn't that that line that I'm talking about?
I think what I'm getting at is that it is vague in all instances. So if the court looks to... if the court defines that constitutional conduct is not implicated and looks to all applications, it is unclear in all applications. The statute, it's not as if it provides standard.
So we do have to make that finding that there are no instances where the statute would apply as currently written.
The only thing I would note on that, Your Honors, is that in some of the cases that we have read in briefing these cases and looking at how the Supreme Court kind of interpreted this doctrine, sometimes the courts don't make reference to all to avoid in all applications or not in all applications. Sometimes it seems that they just simply look to the standards of notice and to arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. But
this is a pre-enforcement case. Would that be helpful to us?
It's a pre-enforcement case, but the arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement is still likely to occur because we're dealing with millions of ammunition transactions annually. This is not, it's not as if it's clear in some circumstances and clear in the majority of circumstances and gray in a few circumstances. This is impossible to, for individuals to have notice of what is or is not used more often than not in a handgun with regard to any cartridges. Unlike standards such as, for example, great bodily injury, where everyone will agree that having an arm severed or permanent paralysis would be great bodily injury, it's not as if some cartridges, the information is available out there that, okay, this ammunition cartridge is used 75% of it all the time in a handgun or not in a handgun. And the point that I was alluding to with expert testimony is an expert testified that he was unaware in his experiences of a rifle that fired a couple of cartridges out of thousands of cartridges. And this information is not known by people who operate, who sell ammunition. The law also applies to people who purchase ammunition. And so to attribute that knowledge based on that doesn't seem like the proper standard to overcome a facial vagueness challenge, because that's knowledge of an expert witness.
What about Mr. Moody's argument? I think he mentioned the 25 automatic and said that it doesn't have any applications at all in rifle use.
Undisputed. I believe that the testimony in the record reflects that a couple of deponents weren't asked about that. Some of them indicated that they believed it was principally for use in a rifle. When asked to speculate as to if
rifle or handgun?
Handgun. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Sheriff Parker, I believe, testified that he's seen it fired in rifles. And so it's not as if they all testified that one doesn't exist. And again, the testimony somewhat conflicted as varying knowledges of firearms and ammunition for one cartridge.
But we're talking about principal use,
right?
Not just any use, principal.
Right, right. And so
you're saying that we can come up with any caliber, any cartridge, anything, and there will always be uncertainty as to whether that ammunition is principally used for a handgun or not?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And to speak to this a little bit is because what is to inform that standard? If we were to impose some sort of standard of known or reasonably should have known based on some factors, like, for example, whether or not the number of firearms or models exist in that firearm, or whether or not it's the number of rifles in a particular caliber that are in circulation, or whether or not it's the actual usage. For example, there may be, say, just to keep the number small, if there were 10 handguns and 3 rifles, usage may very well be more in one in the rifles than in the handgun, and vice versa, obviously. And the point is there's nothing to guide us as to not only what the actual answers to those questions are, but what information should inform the analysis. And the Department of Justice's own expert demonstrated the same difficulty with this. And this is the expert witness for the Department of Justice Bureau of Firearms. And he thought, upon looking at the statute, that it was proper to begin the inquiry by looking to whether or not the number of firearms were sold in handgun models to start his inquiry. And this is information that isn't even available to the general public. Not only is it not available to the general public, there's no ability to compare it for rifle sales because that information doesn't even exist. And so over the course of his deposition, we learned that in order to determine what ammunition he felt the law applied to, which was ultimately 17 cartridges out of thousands, sometimes it was depending on the number of models of handguns. Sometimes it was the number of total firearms in circulation. Sometimes it was how often they were actually used in a firearm versus in a rifle. Sometimes it was the length of time. For example, he chose a 5-year period of sales records to look at. I'm not sure how he came to that period of time. This isn't something certainly that's indicated by the legislative history. And, of course, firearms usage in handguns or in rifles change over time. Sometimes at one point in time, I believe he indicated that the usage in crime had to do with what the law scope should be because it was termed a Crime Prevention Act. And again, where individuals are supposed to, how they're supposed to gather that's a factor put forth in the statute is unclear to us. And then also where we're supposed to obtain that sort of information. So the changing testimony as to what the test even requires in the first place, I think speaks greatly to the vagueness of the law.
Counsel?
Yes.
Do you remember or are you aware of any evidence presented or deposition testimony that was taken involving specifically 22s, where they would fit in?
I don't believe they asked about 22s, and I believe the state intentionally did, and I can't recall exactly. I don't believe they asked about 22s intentionally because the state believes that that is an example of one that they would be unable to make a determination to, even as to themselves. So I think that's one of the examples where the state would acknowledge that there's probably vagueness and uncertainty too, and so they focus on the ones where they thought it was clear that it applied to handgun ammunition, although the testimony demonstrates that that wasn't the case. Answers varied across the board as people, you know, relied on their own subjective knowledge and their interpretation of the standards set forth, and then also as to, you know, how they've seen the firearms used or know of its uses. And oftentimes the case was that they're not familiar with the firearms usage in rifles or in handguns. And this is the case. Ammunition sellers aren't experts in the historical, historical development and number of models that are in existence in firearms and their use in ammunition, and the state's ammunition expert struggled so mightily with this. It speaks largely to the difficulty that ordinary persons that are selling ammunition, millions of transactions on a daily basis, and people purchasing ammunition are going to have in trying to apply the law themselves. And while respondents openly acknowledge that some inquiry might be reasonable, for example, if a law applies to a property principally within county lines or principally within a county, sure, it might be reasonable for them to look at their own property, consult the map, and figure out if their property is more than 51% in the county. But the research process that the Department of Justice's expert witness went through in order to determine what the law should apply to, I mean, this is the sort of research process I don't think that can be tasked upon people trying to comply with a law that aren't experts in firearms. And the ultimate result of it, of course, is speculation. And to this point, the Department of Justice expert testified that after all this, he has a feeling that some cartridges are more often than not handgun ammunition. Again, this is an expert witness that we were talking that we're dealing with, not the ordinarily intelligent person. And on the difficulty of determining whether or not any ammunition is covered, it's not as if individuals are able to look to the cartridges themselves, to look to the ammunition, to look to the product and say, okay, I can tell that this is going to be used in a handgun or in a rifle. Sellers aren't able to look to the purchaser's intended use either. Someone might intend to use a cartridge in a rifle every time they purchase it, or vice versa, but it might actually be more often used in a rifle or more often used in a handgun. And again, to provide a little bit of a comparative analysis with the case that opposing counsel mentioned, the Hoffman Estates case, although that case didn't have factors, I believe it was posters and things that had the primarily intended for use, which listed out examples and had factors and they inferred a scienter requirement, found some scienter requirement, but still went through the vagueness analysis and found that there were some standards set forth by virtue of the listed items and the factors. In Hoffman Estates, that I believe that the language in that law is marketed for use. And so by virtue of the marketed for use standard, it allowed it properly put individuals on notice that how it is being marketed is what a factor is, what should control whether or not any ammunition is going to be subject to the restrictions of not ammunition, but any item is going to be subjected to restrictions of the law. And I think this is an important thing for us to explore because I believe they're called head shops that sell drug paraphernalia. If a head
you
shop,
you believe that?
I don't know if the descriptions of them change over different generations. A head shop is primarily it's operating to sell drug paraphernalia, and items being sold in that world that might have a dual use, such as a roach clip or a glass water pipe that could arguably be used as a vase as well. If someone's purchasing it from a head shop some of the items listed are that they sell are like literally called cocaine freebase kits. If someone's buying a kit, it's not as if it's going to be used for something else. And it's not as if they're buying that same product from, say, Target, or if they're buying a vase or something from the flower shop, that's pretty indicative of an intent. In the world of ammunition, it's not as if purchasers are walking into a a handgun ammunition store, and so it's obvious they're buying it there, and then buying their other ammunition from a rifle ammunition store. At all times, they're walking into a store to buy ammunition, and the manufacturer and the seller, they're intending to manufacture it, of course, and sell it, of course, to anyone who's going to use their product, or even if it's going to sit on a shelf as antique ammunition and not be used, but that it'll be used. They have no knowledge or intention, and they're not meaning for it to be used in one and not in the other. And again, we're not dealing with the marketed for use language that was present in Hoffman either. I'd like to clarify a couple quick points, Your Honors, regarding the court's inquiry regarding a general recognition or a common understanding about ammunition that's principally for use. I think I pretty well alluded to the fact that there isn't a common understanding, and there certainly is not even to with a core group that opposing counsel suggests. They chose to focus on 16 or 17 cartridges out of thousands that they felt are a core group. And some of the things that they pointed to are the marketing classifications, which, again, seem to be a little bit suspect in light of Hoffman because we're not using marketed for use language. But even if we look at the marketing classifications or how encyclopedias reference, such as Cartridges of the World, if we're to look to how those label them or tag them, these materials make no representation at all as to principal use. They routinely refer to the suitability for use in Cartridges of the World. If you take a look at it will document that, for example, the 357 cartridge, one of the most popular cartridges, which appears on the Department of Justice's list, but there's conflicting testimony as to its use. It's a primary example of a cartridge that existed and was developed initially for use in a handgun. And it was developed initially for use in a handgun, but over the years, lots and lots of rifles were developed, cowboy action rifles or lever action rifles that became increasingly popular as cowboy shooting and lever action shooting increased. But it still had associated with it the name of being called handgun ammunition, at least to some. And so while some ammunition manufacturers might term some handgun ammunition, these don't speak in any way to the principal use of that ammunition. And those sources never suggest that they do. There's nothing in the record to this point. These same shippers, even the ones that opposing counsel referred to, I believe Cheaper Than Dirt is one, but numerous shippers, not just the plaintiffs in this case, submitted sworn declarations under penalty of perjury that their marketing classifications, that they are not able to determine which ammunition is more often used in a handgun or more often used in a rifle, and they're unable to determine that because, obviously, it's unclear what the test requires, and it's impossible to actually apply. And so I think that speaks largely to the merits of looking to whether some marketing classifications are tagging or as handgun ammunition or rifle ammunition are even relevant. And then to that point, I think the California courts are pretty clear on the appropriate information. If we're now looking to outside sources as to what should guide our analysis as to the scope of a law, when we're looking to outside sources what definable sources are, typically legislative history, factors in the statute, regulations, case law interpreting a standard. But a case cited in one of the amicus briefs, the one submitted by Gunners of California, but we didn't rely on it for this point, but I think something from that case is very helpful here. And I'll read the citation to the court. It's Robertson v. City and County of Denver, 874 P. 2nd, 325. That case dealt with laws restricting certain firearms based on their design history. And so the argument was that they could look to sources and figure out their design history. Well, it was initially designed for use in this firearm, and it was clear that was what the standard was initially designed for use in. And the court reasoned that whether persons must necessarily guess as to a law's meaning does not turn on whether some source exists for determining proper application. The court noted specifically that no source was referenced in the statute. Here, of course, the case is even worse, as any sources that the state might like us to turn to don't even speak to a cartridge's principal use.
Isn't the scienter element, if it's inserted, dispose of all of your arguments? Because if if someone is charged with violating the statute, the prosecutor would have to prove that that person, that vendor, knew or should have known that that ammo was principally used for handguns. And if they can't prove that that's true and that that person knew or should have known, they're not convicted.
I understand your question, Your Honor, and I think that it does not cure the vagueness problems. And the reason is this: in looking at the prongs of the vagueness test, we're dealing with two prongs. One, notice, and then secondly, unequal or arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. And here, nothing would be solved by the problem of notice, because it's not as if, even if we said that statute would require persons to know or reasonably should know, there is nothing to inform them of what the test should require, no sources for them to turn to, no place to even find this information. So persons still aren't going to be on notice. And kind of, you know, separately and apart in that arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement, the other prong, which has become the more important prong, although they're kind of interrelated here, law enforcement aren't going to have notice of this either because of the lack of standards and the inability to determine whether any ammunition is. But not only...
Don't those arguments fall mostly in an as-applied attack as opposed to a pre-enforcement facial attack? We're having to suppose a lot of things to get where you want us to go.
I don't think so, Your Honor, and that's because the law is no more clear with regard to some ammunition than other ammunition. It's impossible to define in all circumstances. It's not as if the law lists out a few examples that we're going to know are going to be covered, and then hypothetical situations might come up. These questions are unknown and are going to have to be answered and applied, and will be obviously applied differently by anyone attempting to interpret the law as to any ammunition. And with respect to arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement, even if, as you suggested, an ultimate conviction wasn't able to be obtained, that's still going through the process of erratic arrests, erratic prosecutions. And even if a conviction can't ultimately be obtained, the law, and which would then seem pretty interesting because that would apparently ultimately serve no purpose because this law can't be imputed on someone, it would still result in those harms which are going to remain. And then additionally, one last point on the scienter is that, and this kind of ties into my clarification I want to make regarding the Second Amendment here, the interplay of it, is that we're still dealing with criminal statutes. It's not as if we're imposing a scienter requirement that aren't that where criminal penalties aren't at issue, and we're still dealing with constitutionally protected conduct. And to that point, while I feel like the briefing and everything demonstrates that the law is vague, certainly vague, in all of its application and doesn't provide clarity as to some where there are factors listed or examples listed. On the relevance of the Second Amendment to this lawsuit, it seems in the appellant's briefing, and it seems supported by their argument today, that their argument is that, I won't re-argue anything other. I think our brief sufficiently covered other than this, but the state seems to suggest that Heller doesn't foreclose commercial ammunition or firearms regulations. We don't disagree, Your Honors. And this law very well might likely survive a Second Amendment facial challenge. But that's not what is before the court. And laws restricting or abutting upon constitutionally protected conduct, in this case, the purchase of ammunition, still triggers heightened review and impinges upon or implicates protected Second Amendment conduct, regardless of whether the statutes in and of themselves violate the Second Amendment on their face. This law is unlike cases where a criminal challenges a law, for instance, based on the ability to possess a felon in possession of firearms or ammunition, conduct that is outside the scope of the Second Amendment. We're still dealing with conduct inside the scope of the Second Amendment, and the state doesn't seem to dispute that the challenge laws implicate protected Second Amendment conduct. But I would just like to again clarify that we don't believe our case rests upon the application of a heightened standard here. If the court has any additional questions, otherwise I'll move to my closing comments.
Go forward, sir.
Your Honors, we're not asking for mathematical certainty. We're not suggesting that a list is required in this case and in all other cases. But some further level of clarity is required here. These aren't hypothetical harms that are potentially likely to occur in the future. These are harms. These are going to impact the transfer of millions of transfers of ammunition the day the law is set into place. And we're not arguing whether this is a good public policy, whether it's a good idea to have laws like this in the books. And affirming the trial court's judgment and some further level of clarity is required in these laws, it's not going to spell doom for future versions of these laws. And finally, laws with this wide-ranging impact on purchasers, sellers, and individuals engaging in constitutional rights should provide some level of clarity beyond an unknowable standard, which is essentially what we're dealing with. We respectfully request that the court affirm the trial court's judgment. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Let me just address a few of these points. I think that one point that has gotten lost here is this contention that this law applies to handgun purchasers, and it doesn't. It applies to vendors. The restrictions are on vendors, keeping the material in a certain location.
Getting thumbprint, that's a purchaser, isn't it?
There is no criminal liability associated with violating
you
it.
You just can't buy the ammunition if you won't give your thumbprint.
That's true. The claim has been that you need to understand what should be kept behind the counter if you are just buying ammunition, and it's simply not true. If you were to purchase ammunition for which you should have provided the thumbprint, you would not be prosecuted. The vendor might be prosecuted, but you as the buyer would not be prosecuted.
And it still probably won't be as hard to buy ammunition as it is spray paint.
Well, what doesn't the law apply to the transfer of ammunition?
The point is that they dropped a footnote that said they noted the language that said a violation of this section is a misdemeanor, and they suggested that purchasers could be charged with a misdemeanor if there's a violation of the statute. But when you read the statute, all of the burdens and obligations and responsibilities imposed by the statute are on the person transferring, selling, vending the.
Okay, so I give it to my next door neighbor. Aren't I in violation of the statute according to the way it's written?
You would not be charged with a crime, I don't believe. Now that is a circumstance that is outside the particular thing I'm trying to clear up.
Well, what I'm trying to clear up here is that your statement that it applies only to vendors and those that sell, I don't think that's accurate. I think we have to assume that it applies to a broader group than that.
Okay, I accept that given your hypothetical, that might be true. But the point is that the requirement for storage, restricting it from being handled by people with criminal background in your employ, requiring a thumbprint, segregating ammunition principally for use in a handgun versus rifle ammunition, those are duties that go to the vendors. And setting aside the transfer from you to your neighbor, which I confess I have not read the statute carefully enough to see whether that would be criminally liable, that is not the main import of the statute, certainly. And that might be ripe for an as-applied challenge if, in fact, it were true.
Mr. Munford said in his argument, and I hope I correctly understood it, that even applying the strict standard, which you say we should apply, this law is vague in every instance. What's your response to that?
I don't understand how you can make that statement. I think that if you apply the strict standard we have in this record, and even if you don't want to reference the record, you're certainly free to read the statute and use your own life experiences, there are simply many cartridges that are principally for use in a handgun. Now, I've pointed out the ones like the 25 automatic, which, you know, the sheriff testified he's seen it fired in a rifle. Well, if it'll fit in a rifle and someone shoots it, we all know how that can go if you're just having fun on the back 40. But does that say that it's chambered for a rifle? I've seen people do some pretty stupid stuff with firearms, but that's not support for a facial challenge. And one key that I would like to point out here is that when this lawsuit was brought, it contained an as-applied and a facial challenge, and they dismissed their as-applied challenge. So a lot of the information that was developed in this case I think, was going towards that. But they dropped that contention. And I think they should suffer the burden of having to stick with what they actually pled, which was this facial challenge.
Of course, he said there was no evidence presented of persons of reasonable intelligence. So,
I'm not going to comment on that. But I will defend our expert and say that he did not struggle with the issue. I mean, if you've ever read an expert deposition, he gave his opinions, and then he, you know, there was 3 hours of cross-examination. That doesn't mean that he had trouble coming up with his list. I don't think that there is a struggle. I think that in the main, this is pretty clear. One of the examples that was used by Mr. Monfort was great bodily injury, and he suggested that this was not like great bodily injury, which is so easy to determine. I think that if anyone's ever practiced criminal law, you know that's always on the table, and that's subject to a lot of discussion and debate as to what's great bodily injury. And we cited a passage from a California Supreme Court case in our reply brief where the court went through and listed all of the instances where non-mathematical standards are applied in the penal codes, and generally where you have to, you know, decide what's reasonable, prudent, necessary and proper, substantial. We gave a list of statutes that use, if not principally, words that are like it. There is definitely an opportunity to learn what is being prohibited by the law. And I think that one thing that was not answered by my opponent was the notion that because this is commercial conduct that we're talking about, that that they are on notice, that they need to figure out how to run their business legally and to figure out what the statute might mean to them. And that's different than something that applies more broadly. Now, I will note that when we talk about the Hoffman case, the head shop case, that there was a focus on marketed for use. There were two components to that ordinance. One of them was marketed for use, but the other one was designed for use. And the opponents of the ordinance in that case made arguments very similar to the ones being advanced here, along the lines of, how do we know it's in the designer's mind? How are we to intuit that?
Do you see any, do you yourself make any distinction between the product being sold in the Hoffman case vis-a-vis handgun ammunition or ammunition and, oh, that Second Amendment? Do you see how it has any relevance in this case? You simply want to view it as a commercial transaction?
I think that based on what I've read in the record and in the signing message and the legislative history of this case, apparently the experience of law enforcement was that when they had this type of ordinance requiring a thumbprint and recordation of handgun ammunition sales in municipalities, they were able to use that to develop leads for criminal investigations. And so as someone here representing the Department of Justice, when Governor Schwarzenegger signed the law and said, I think that this will aid prosecutions, I think it will aid law enforcement, I will take that at face value. I'm too old now to have to show ID when I buy alcohol, but it never particularly troubled me. And I live in San Francisco. I won't go through what I have to do to buy ammunition in the city and county of San Francisco, but I assure you that I might stop somewhere in Fresno County before I
return
home.
You could buy a hash pipe easier.
I'm sure you're right. There's no question that you're right.
What troubles me, if we interpret there to be a scienter requirement, which everybody seems to agree we can, that scienter requirement, that would be the knowledge of the person that it would be subject to this statute or these statutes. And it'd be the reasonably smart, maybe even gun-educated vendor, something similar to that, right?
Sure.
Okay. And then you have the second requirement that if you're going to be reasonable, be judged on a reasonably intelligent standard, you have the reasonably intelligent gun shooter. How do the two, how is an average shipper supposed to determine whether it's reasonable to ship one kind of ammunition versus another?
Without
a list or a general reference point or something.
I think that based on my knowledge of handguns and rifles, which is about mid-range, I'm no expert, but I'm not a novice either, that you can come up with a pretty solid list that you would categorize as being covered. And then you'd come up with another list that you would scratch your head about. And then you would come up with a third list that you'd say, I don't think this is covered. And then you would take that list in the middle, and you'd really puzzle over it. And if you were a conservative person, you probably would err on the side of treating it like ammunition, principally for use in a handgun. And I think that given the fact that this product can be used to inflict great bodily injury, death, can be used in crime, can be used for lawful purposes too, make no mistake. But when it's used improperly, there are terrible consequences, that it does not offend me that there might be some gray area. Much as in the list of examples that I was talking about, where if you guess wrong, if you're a little aggressive, you might end up being prosecuted for something. Would a list be nice? Yes, a list would be nice. I agree. I think that the efforts to add a list were definitely in the spirit of clarifying things. But the question is, on a facial challenge, did they really show that there's no legitimate application of this law? And I don't think that they did. And because that's true, we ask that you reverse the trial court in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Moody. Thank both counsel. Those very good arguments. The matter will stand submitted, and we will again be in a very brief recess while the panel is reconstituted.